So our goal tonight is to pick up where we left off last week. And last week, we focused in on the kind of like the final week or two of Jesus' life, dealing with that that week leading up to his crucifixion, John 11, looking at the resurrection of Lazarus. Tonight, what we want to do, and it's ambitious, we want to look as much in as much detail as we can the final 24 hours. So from the time of the Passover all the way up until and through his crucifixion. So the first two points covering the Passover and Gethsemane were probably going to go pretty quick, whereas his trials and the crucifixion itself will take some time with. So if it feels like we're rushing for a few minutes, that's probably why, and we'll slow down once we get to our final two points. So, all right, so the Passover. Why did Jesus want to keep the Passover with his disciples? We know at one point he said that it was very important. He had desired to share this feast with his disciples, Luke 22, verses 14 through 16. Any idea why that was a priority of all things? Why would that be important?
For the same reasons it's important to us, who we spend holidays with.
Okay, yeah.
People that are important to
us. Our family, yeah, friends, okay. What was the significance of that final Passover? What's going on? What's taking place? Yes, ma'am. He institutes the Lord's Supper. Yes, ma'am. Did you have something? Okay, that was it.
1 Corinthians 5:7 says he is our Passover.
So yeah, yeah. And a really cool correlation with that is in Exodus 12, verse 5, the type of lamb that they were supposed to specify was what? Spotless, without blemish. Well, 1 Peter 1:19 makes that connection between that lamb and Jesus, saying that he was also supposed to be spotless and without blemish. And of course he was. The institution of the Lord's Supper, and also Jesus kept the law perfectly. And so as a Jewish man, to keep the law perfectly, he had to keep the Passover. So of course that would have played into it as well. Look in Matthew 26. Matthew 26, and we're going to take the same approach tonight that we did last week. We're not going to get too deep into the spiritual side of things. Obviously, this is all spiritual, but we're going to focus more on some historical details, hopefully help us to appreciate and know more about the these narratives. So Matthew 26, someone read verse 17, please.
Now on the first day of the feast of the unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying to him, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?"
Okay, so this might be confusing, and in fact some people have even cited this verse as a contradiction. What two feasts are mentioned here? Feast of the Unleavened Bread and the Passover. Someone's going to say, well, I thought they were supposed to be taking the Passover. Why does it say here the Feast of Unleavened Bread? Take place right after each other. And so you're going to transition from the Passover. The very next day starts the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Excuse me. I just had a cup of coffee, so I'm kind of jittery. Excuse me. The Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so it's 8 days of feasting, right back to back. And so many times in Jewish culture, they would use one to refer to the other. If I'm using my literary terms correctly, Anna, I believe that's called a synecdoche. You can use one to refer to something else. Okay, so a synecdoche here, you can use the Feast of Unleavened Bread to refer to the Passover and vice versa. And many times the authors will do this. And so it's the same feast. They're simply, I would say, using the cultural parlance at that time to refer to the two feasts separately. So I thought that was interesting. If you want to read more up on the distinction between those two feasts, Exodus 12 verses 1 through 20. Exodus 12, verses 1 through 20. Drop down to verse 23 through 25. Someone like to read that for us?
And he answered and said, "He that dippeth his hand with me in this dish, the same shall betray me. The Son of Man goeth as it is written of him, but woe unto that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It had been good for that man if he had not been born." And Judas, which betrayed him, answered and said, "Master, is it I?" He said unto him, "Thou hast said."
I find it interesting in verse 25. Notice the verb form there. He doesn't say who was going to betray him. It says who was betraying him. He was in the process of betraying him. But the point that we want to capitalize on here in this verse, Notice that it says, Rabbi, is it I? All the other apostles, it seems, had used this exact same phrase. But if you look at the actual meaning of the word, another possible implication of this phrase is, Jesus, surely it's not me. Surely it's not me. It couldn't be me. I wouldn't do this. So you can imagine the irony that Jesus senses when Judas, who is in the process of betraying him, says, Rabbi, surely it's not me. It couldn't be me. Whereas he's in the process of doing the exact same thing that Jesus told him he was doing. Another note about the betrayal is that Jesus knew from the beginning who would betray him. John 6 and verse 64. If someone does something wrong to you, is it a struggle to treat them fairly moving forward? Is it a struggle to not let that past interaction affect your relationship moving forward? I would say yes. But in Jesus' position, his entire ministry, he knew what was coming. And yet we never get any distinction that Jesus treated Judas any differently, that he treated him poorly. He knew what was to come, and yet Judas was just seen as one of the apostles. So that's a testament to Jesus' character and who he was as a person, that he could know what someone was going to do to him and still be a person of grace and fairness and kindness. And that's the theme of Jesus. All through this final 24-hour period, he's conducted himself with grace in possibly the most stressful of all potential situations. He was grace itself, which is, again, a testament to his character. Any comments on the Passover? Again, these two points we're going to move very quickly. Thoughts or comments? Okay, let's transition to Gethsemane. Turn to Luke 22. So in verse 44.
And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was as it were great drops of blood falling down to the ground.
So some have referred to this phenomenon as hematidrosis. And hematidrosis is an actual physical ailment where under extreme duress, under extreme stress, people's subcutaneous blood vessels, their capillaries, will burst and blood will be mixed with their sweat. Some have said that, no, this is just an analogy. It's as great drops of blood. My question be, why use as great drops of blood specifically? I believe that it's hematidrosis, and it makes sense from the context because Luke, we know, is a physician. And he tends to, for instance, the woman with the issue of blood, he really focuses in on that woman. He talks about the ailment. He talks about what she had suffered from the different physicians. And so it's very, very on character for him to focus in on a physical anatomical ailment. And so that makes sense in my eyes that this would be an actual condition and not just an analogy. Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
It's a good observation because even in Acts, when the man who is at the gate called Beautiful, Luke said that his ankle bones received strength.
Mm-hmm.
Ankle bones. See how detailed he was?
Specific, right. Pardon, my laptop is having difficulties. Okay. So the hematidrosis note. Another point that has been made I think is really interesting is I don't know if we have the Bible Land Passage DVDs in the back. We don't. But I need to talk to World Video Bible School about getting us a set. If you look at the terrain surrounding Jerusalem, Jerusalem is on a little hill. So it's like you go up a mountain to get to Jerusalem, and then you go down, and then at the bottom of this bowl is Jerusalem. And so it's you go down, you go up, you go down, and then you go up again. More than likely, Gethsemane was going to be outside of the city. So probably if you're leaving Jerusalem, it probably would have been higher than Jerusalem itself. And so more than likely, Jesus would have been able to see the mob coming as soon as they left the city. That's interesting to me because human biology has this fancy thing called fight or flight. And if you know that you're about to be put to death and you see the mob maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes away from you, every single impulse in your body is going to say, we got to go. It's time to get out of here. But again, Jesus stayed. So the amount of control, not only that he had during temptation, but over his instincts to run away from what was coming, to resist and to flee and to say whatever needed to be said to get himself out of the situation, he overcame those things. That is the definition of strength of character, of the strength of will. I mean, to literally disregard those fight or flight impulses, I mean, what else can you say? That is strength itself. So again, that point is amazing to me. I will try and get a set for us of those Bible Land Passage DVDs. I found them very helpful. Let's look at the betrayal, and then we'll slow down as soon as we get past this point. The betrayal. Turn to John 18. John 18. Right now, we're just hitting some highlights, looking at Jesus' character before we slow down. But this is another point that I've always found interesting. John 18. Will someone read verses 1 through 3, please?
When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples over the brook of Kidron, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. And Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Then Judas, having received a detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons.
Okay, so you're Judas. It's during the Passover. You know that you've already arranged with the chief priests, I'm going to come find you, and I'll tell you when it's a good time to come take Jesus. Judas leaves before the Passover is instituted. So he leaves to go talk to the chief priest. And he doesn't see Jesus again until they're in Gethsemane. How does he know where to take the chief priest and the soldiers to? How does he know? That's where they met often. It was the habit of Jesus. It was tradition. It was ritual to take his disciples to the garden. That's also amazing to me. The fact that Jesus was so predictable. Again, at this point in time, you know that people are looking for you to kill you. Predictability is not a trait that's very life-preserving. So you don't want that. But that point aside, he was so known for going apart by himself to work with his disciples, to teach them and to pray, that Judas, he knew just automatically where to take these men. He knew where his master was going to be. And again, that says something about Jesus, that during this point in time, he knew that he needed to be in prayer. He needed some time alone with his disciples to focus with them. So, comments or thoughts on that?
Men of God should be predictable to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
Just like when we see Daniel and the decree went out.
Mm-hmm.
He opened up his windows toward Jerusalem. He prayed. They knew he was going to do that.
Yeah.
It's predictable.
Yeah.
It's the same. And so, just like with us, people know where we're going to be on the first day of the week. It's going to be right here.
Yeah.
So, hey, 10:30, they'll be over there. We'll go get them in. And showed up. Here they come.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah. Good point. Okay, so let's slow down. We've looked at the Passover. We looked at Gethsemane. Now let's get to his trials. His trials. And these two separate points, I feel like, need a little bit more analysis than maybe Gethsemane or the Passover. Turn to Luke 3. Luke 3. This passage is really going to help us break down what's going on in Jesus' final. Really, we're down to almost 18 hours. Luke 3. Someone read verses 1 and 2, please.
Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate, being governor of Judea, Herod, being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea, and the region of Trachonitis, and Lysias, tetrarch of Abilene, when Ananias became Caiaphas, the high priest. The word of God came to John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness, and he went into the region, all the region around the Jordan, preaching a baptism of repentance for the remission of sins.
Okay, thank you. So there are four heavy hitters that really come into play in these final 18 hours for Jesus, mentioned in Luke 3. And the cool thing about this verse is it historically characterizes and gives us an idea of what role they played. Pontius Pilate, of course, we're very familiar with him. He was the governor of Judea. Herod is going to come into play. This is Herod Antipas, and he is the tetrarch of Galilee, so just north of Pontius Pilate's terrain or territory. And then at almost the end of verse 2, while Annas and Caiaphas were high priests. What about that last phrase strikes you as odd? There's two. Why is that weird? There's supposed to be one. How do we explain this? Why are there two high priests? Annas and Caiaphas. Does anyone know?
I don't know if I'm right or not, but I think Ananias was the one that's coming in. Caiaphas was just kind of like finishing up.
Okay, so it's opposite. It's opposite. Annas was Caiaphas' father-in-law. We find that in... I didn't write that specific verse down. I believe it's John 11. Let me check that really quick. I'm looking in John 11:49. Do you have something, Mike? 11:49. You want to read that for us? Nope, that's not it.
Nope.
Not the one I'm looking for. There's a passage that says specifically that Caiaphas was Annas' son-in-law. 18:13. Okay. You want to read that for us, Dennis?
Let him raise Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year.
Okay. So... Annas was high priest, I believe, from 87 to AD 14. So about 7-year period, very early on in Jesus' life, Annas would have been high priest. Since that time, 5 of Annas' sons had been high priest. And now Caiaphas, his son-in-law, was high priest. The interesting thing is Annas just never went away. He just never left. In fact, many historical writers have Annas has almost been like a boss. He had turned the role of chief priest into a very, very corrupted, very, very lucrative position. They were wealthy. I mean, they were wealth itself. They were pretty much some of the most wealthy people in Jerusalem because of their manipulation. Again, going back to what we talked about last week, Caiaphas and Annas, they were responsible for the money changers in the temple courts. And so these people, the Jews had said, well, we're not going to allow you to use Roman coins to pay for your sacrifices because Roman coins had Caesar's face on them. And they said, that's idolatry. You have to use Jewish coins. And so whenever you come from outlying lands, you need to change your money over to Jewish coins and then pay for your sacrifices with those. But the thing is the rates that they would charge people was insane. It was robbery itself. And of course, they would take all that benefit for themselves, and that's partly why Caiaphas and Annas were so wealthy. So these were not godly men. These were not good men. They would do whatever it took to maintain their power, regardless of what laws they had to break in the process. So that's why there were two high priests. Caiaphas was officially high priest. He was the one with the official title. However, many times the Bible writers will very tongue-in-cheek refer to Annas as the high priest because he was working in the shadows. He was always behind the scenes pulling the strings. So that's an explanation of why there were two high priests, if anyone ever asks you. So this is not a contradiction. It's historically and archaeologically proven that there were these two men kind of interacting with each other at the same time. Any thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Look at 2 Samuel 15 and 1 Kings. 25, 2 Kings 25, you'll see where there seems to be other occasions where there were multiple priests or chief priests working in accordance, first, second, third stage.
Okay.
So by this time, the abuses.
Yeah.
You know, the political power that was being wielded. You got to remember that under Moses' law, it's a theocratic law.
Mm-hmm.
So not only was it a religious law, it was a law that was governed the actual taxation and their tithing and so forth. And
yeah.
So their legal justice system. So the priest would become very highly authorized.
Yeah.
Similar to Roman Catholicism.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point.
Stephen, also,
yes, sir.
You think of the oppression of the governmental officials and then the oppression of the religious officials. The people of God almost didn't have a chance. Therefore, mm-hmm. when Jesus came on the scene, come unto me,
yeah.
it was very refreshing.
Yeah.
He's freeing us
mm-hmm.
from both of them.
Yeah.
Yet, in Matthew 23, Jesus tells his disciples that the religious leaders were actually preaching the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't political.
Yeah.
So they had it on both sides.
Okay. Looking, yes, someone has something. They had shown themselves very willing to bend the rules to do whatever needed to be done. So yeah, absolutely. The fact that there were two of them operating in this way is not at all surprising. Okay, so in John 18, this is the first stop. After they leave Gethsemane, this is stop number one, as they go to Annas, the house of Annas. Start in verse 12. We're already in John 18. Someone read 12 through 14. Please.
This man and the captain and officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him and led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people.
Okay, so the first place that they go is where? To Annas' house. From what I understand, Annas and Caiaphas more than likely lived in the same complex. The same, because back then, I mean, you didn't, whenever you left your parents' home, more than likely you stayed very, very close. And so, from what I understand, they more than likely stayed within like, speaking distance of each other. So they had these very weird arrangements where the houses were kind of in a courtyard. And so, really, you live across the courtyard from your family members. And so, more than likely, they go to Annas' house, and then they're going to go to Caiaphas' house, and then they'll go to Pilate. And so, the transition from Annas to Caiaphas was more than likely very, very short. So, they go to Annas, then they go to Caiaphas. Let's talk for just a second about the idea of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, that word is never used in Scripture from what I understand, at least in the English. However, the Greek word is there. I don't remember what the Greek word is specifically, but Sanhedrin is a transliteration of the Greek word. It's just spelled just a little bit different. It's translated as council in most Scriptures. And so whenever you see council, it's the Sanhedrin. Well, what is the Sanhedrin? It was patterned after Moses' collection of 70 elders. If you turn to Numbers 11, verse 16, Moses collected 70 elders, and then he was kind of on the board himself. And so there were 71 men that were to oversee the justice process. Well, the Sanhedrin, the council during Jesus' day, was modeled after this collection of elders that Moses had. So it would have been composed of 24 chief priests and 46 elders from different sects. So the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the scribes. Now that's interesting because that ties up a lot of loose ends for us. Whenever these Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes are coming to Jesus and tempting him or trying to get him to mess up in what he's saying, that's because they're all on the same team. These people hate each other. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, they despised each other. But they were working together because many times they were on the Sanhedrin together. And then so it was this collection of 71 men, and they would vote. And the chief priest was kind of the overseer of this group of 71 men. And that also explains something else for us. You know, many times I've thought, well, during this time that Jesus is being crucified, Nicodemus was a Pharisee, and we have reason to believe that other Pharisees were believers as well. They were simply afraid of being kicked out of the synagogue. Why didn't they say anything during these proceedings? And the fact is that if the majority of them wanted Jesus to die, it didn't matter what Nicodemus did. He was just one vote out of 71. And so if the majority of them wanted Jesus to die, then that's what was going to happen. So that might give a little bit of explanation as to why we don't hear from Nicodemus here. There could have been 30 people who didn't want Jesus to die on the Sanhedrin, but it didn't matter because the majority of them found him guilty. So hopefully that's helpful. Yes?
Didn't the scripture also say that he didn't consent to... the man who had begged the body of Jesus said that that was Joseph. He said he hadn't consented to Jesus' death. But didn't it make it sound like was he part of that council? Like, maybe he said something but we don't have his dialogue?
I believe the phrase there... Saul was consenting to Stephen's death. Joseph of Arimathea?
Yeah.
Yeah, Nicodemus was there with Joseph. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, I haven't looked into that connection with Nicodemus after the crucifixion. That's a good point. So... Okay, anything else? Yeah.
In John 11, when Caiaphas actually prophesied,
mm-hmm.
prophecy, did he understand that prophecy? Did he understand that he was prophesying? Or did he, like a better question, did he fully understand that he was prophesying?
I think it actually says in the text... That's interesting, yeah. I would say not, because it says in John 11:51, this he did not say on his own authority. So that could be some sort of reference to him not knowing what he was saying. Yeah. Yeah, and he didn't know that he was prophesying was the interesting part.
So going back to what Anna was talking about, Mark 15:43.
Okay. Okay. Is that what you're looking for, Anna? Mark 15:13. 15:43, excuse me. Okay. Well done. Okay.
Stephen, if you look at the Catholic Church real closely,
mm-hmm.
it's set up like the Sanhedrin.
Okay. I have to take your word for it. I haven't.
I just threw that out there for
you. Okay. All right, so we've looked at Annas. They go from Annas to Caiaphas. We've talked about the Sanhedrin very quickly. The Jews had a Jewish law, and then there was also a rabbinical law. And something interesting about the crucifixion of Jesus is the number of rabbinical laws that the Sanhedrin was willing to break to get Jesus on the cross. I'll just read through a few of these. Number one, this wasn't a rabbinical law. This was... from the law of Moses, the high priest was not allowed to rip his clothing. Leviticus 21 and verse 10, yet the high priest rips his garment when Jesus confesses. So I believe it would have been Caiaphas in that instance. Number two, legal proceedings could not take place after sundown and could not take place before morning sacrifices. His trial went through most of the night, so that was illegal. Number three, of course, the raising up of false prophets. That's also the law of Moses. Nothing rabbinical about that. Deuteronomy 19, verses 16 through 19, specify that if you prophesy falsely against someone, the punishment that you were trying to get for them should go to you. And so the men who rose up and had false witness against Jesus, technically the law says that they should have been scourged and crucified, which is interesting. Number four, a full day of fasting had to be observed by the council between the passing of sentence and the execution of the criminal. What we find in Scripture is the Sanhedrin meets, they find Jesus guilty, and then they immediately march him to Pilate to be put to death. There's no time at all. They go from, you've been found guilty, verdict is guilty, now let's punish you, let's sentence you to death. This was also against their traditions. Going back to what Catherine said, only a week before, they had been very big fans of their traditions, but as long as they were convenient. Traditions were great, and they expected other people to follow them, but they didn't follow them themselves. They were willing to break them if it was convenient, if it helped them in their cause. So hypocrisy at its finest. Another point, under Roman law, Jews were not allowed to put people to death, so that's why they took him to Pilate. And a passage for that is John 18, verse 31. John 18, 31. Someone read that for us.
Then said Pilate unto them, take him and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death.
Okay, so the Romans had come in, and Romans didn't care what religion you followed. They didn't care. They had no preference. You do whatever you want to, just don't cause problems. But the one thing is you can't put anyone to death. They would overlook it if someone was stoned for not keeping a religious law. But for the Sanhedrin, the official council, to put someone to death, that was a no-go. That was bad. That was not something that would go well. And the Sanhedrin understood this, and so they said, okay, we want to put him to death. We can't do it ourselves because then we're in danger. So what have we got to do? We've got to find not only spiritual charges, but we've got to find some reason that Pilate would want to put them to death. So what do they come up with? What are some of the charges that they bring against Jesus? He was a king. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. Yeah, so the point that she made is back at Annas and Caiaphas' house, they had said, well, he is guilty of blasphemy because he claims to be the Son of God. But then they get to Pilate's house, and what are the charges they bring? This man claims to be a king. That's completely different. And so they're willing to lie, spin the narrative, whatever they need to do to get this man dead before lunch. Whatever it takes, they're willing to do whatever they need to do. Yeah.
Working the council for the Jewish community, and then to the work Pilate in the Romans.
Yeah. It's a lot of manipulation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that, Catherine, is the Jewish leaders already had a leg up on Pilate. Pilate and the Sanhedrin did not get along very well. I was doing a little bit of reading today, and there had been a previous riot where the Jewish leaders had written a letter to Tiberius, the current Caesar, and they had accused Pilate of some things. Well, Pilate, trying to get out ahead of them, wrote his own letter to Tiberius, and he got in a mess of trouble with Caesar. And so he was already on the chopping block. There had been another riot that Rome was upset with him about. And so Pilate probably understood, listen, this is it. If I mess this up, if this doesn't go well, if the Sanhedrin writes another letter to Tiberius, I could lose my job, I could lose my career, I could lose my head, potentially. So he has everything to lose at this point. So Pilate was very hesitant to be manipulated by the Sanhedrin, but at the same time, there's only so much that he could do to keep them from going to Tiberius, which, again, This is a point we'll get to in just a second. But Herod Antipas, which was the same Herod who killed John the Baptist, Herod Antipas built the city of Tiberias. So I don't know if you've ever heard of the city of Tiberias, but it was actually in Jesus, I don't want to say stomping grounds, but Jesus, the area where Jesus typically preached, was there was a city known as Tiberias. And the Jews didn't go there because it was seen as an unclean city. But Herod Antipas built that city for the emperor and named it after the emperor. So kind of a feather in his own cap to build a city for the emperor and then name it after the emperor. So that gives you a little bit of insight into how much power Herod Antipas had. So I thought that was interesting. Any thoughts or comments on the trials? I did want to get to the crucifixion itself before time gets away from us. Yes, ma'am. Okay. You want to read that for us? Yeah.
So I guess we don't know if he didn't consent silently or if he didn't consent out loud.
I've never noticed that before. I'd never made the connection that Joseph was a member of the Sanhedrin. Because, again, that's what council literally means is Sanhedrin there. Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I'm going to make a note of that. So, yeah, very cool. Very cool. Okay, so getting to the crucifixion itself. I'm not going to do it. I have a paper written by a medical doctor about crucifixion, and there's some really interesting diagrams that I found interesting of what crucifixion looked like from an anatomical perspective. They're just black and white drawings, but I have the paper. If you would like to see it, you are more than welcome to do so. I will not put them up on the screen for fear of... The nurses among us would enjoy that, but I will not do that. So, but we will. This next section will be. We'll try to be as helpful as possible, and with helpful comes details. And so, we'll do what we can. With crucifixion, it was custom for the victim to more than likely be stripped completely naked, and so. In the depictions of Jesus, the loincloth around him, more than likely that was not the case. That explains Psalm 22, verse 18. Again, they divide my garments, more than likely, all of his garments between them. And I know that it actually says the number of garments, doesn't it, Dennis? The number of garments that they had. I'll have to do some more research into that.
Cloak and tunic.
Cloak and tunic, okay. So whenever it comes to crucifixion, the weight that would have been placed on the body, minutes after crucifixion, the shoulders, the elbows, and the wrists would have dislocated. And many times it's depicted that the nail would have gone through the palm. That's not capable of holding up a full man's weight. And so the nail would have gone right there between the radius and the ulna. The problem with that is that's where the median nerve is. And so that would have been severed when the nail went through. So literally every movement would have been excruciating. Ironically, that's where the word excruciating comes from, is the word crucify. So that's another connection. Someone turn to Psalm 22, and I'm going to have you read several verses from that. Psalm 22. I'd like it. Well, I don't guess it really matters who reads. Someone read Psalm 22, verse 18. Excuse me, verse 14.
I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is so black, it's melted in the midst of my bowels.
Okay, so that phrase there, all my bones are out of joint. Of course, we know Psalm 22 is a messianic prophecy. It's referring to Jesus' crucifixion. It says, all my bones are out of joint. His joints would have dislocated. Doctors estimate that this would have added as much as 9 inches to his wingspan. And this was only minutes after crucifixion. We've already talked about where the nails were placed, again, so just below the metacarpals there. The deal with crucifixion is that it slowed down the breathing. And what we mean that it slows down the breathing is whenever they would position the person being crucified, they would send the nail in the feet. So if this is a person's foot, it would have gone through the bones of the feet. So between those bones and then foot on top of foot. And what would have happened is the legs would have been bent up at 45 degrees. And so what happens is whenever you're relaxed, you're in this sagging posture. But what takes place is you can't breathe like that because it's constricting your diaphragm. And eventually, something happens to the pectoral muscles, your chest muscles, to where they're at max capacity. And so if you ever like open your chest up to where it's max capacity and then tighten your abs to simulate being hunched over like this, you can't breathe. You can't breathe. That would have been the relaxed position. And so in crucifixion, he would have to push up against the nails to release his diaphragm so that he could breathe and then relax back down again. You can't hold this position because with your feet the way that they are, you can't use your calf muscles. You can only use your thigh muscles. And so eventually, after so many hours, you can't hold that anymore and you're going to sink down. But you have to move again because if you don't move, you don't breathe. So the Romans would attach a small wooden seat. And so there wasn't like a platform for his feet because his feet were nailed, but there would have been like a small wooden platform in between. So just where his backside would have been, he could sit on that seat. And because of this, crucifixion could go on for 9 days. 9 days, because it would enable you to kind of find a midpoint between the fully relaxed and the fully extended. Eventually, again, the chest capacity would be... Did I lose my mic? No. The chest capacity would be in a permanent position of maximal respiratory inspiration. And again, so your chest is fully expanded. And people would frequently pass out during crucifixion because you're not getting enough oxygen. So you're not getting enough oxygen, pass out, but you pass out and so you relax. Relax, you can't breathe. And so you pass out and you come back and you start lifting again and then you pass out. And so it's a nightmare of a cycle. And what's going to be taking place medically during all this is, of course, your oxygen levels are going to decrease because you can't breathe. But because you can't breathe out either, your CO2 levels are also going to rise. So you've got the medical geniuses among us, hypoxia, which is blood oxygen levels decreasing, CO2 levels increasing, which is hypercapnia. I'm a physicist. I don't do this stuff. So so because of those two things, you would have an increased heart rate, which is tachycardia. And so this article by this doctor that I have here, he estimates that Jesus' heart rate would have been somewhere in the 200s during the crucifixion process. Because, again, no oxygen. And also blood pressure is going down because of the scourging, because of the blood loss. And so blood pressure would also be decreasing. This process, the need to breathe and the inability to breathe, this explains why the Romans would break the legs of people that they wanted to expedite the death process. Because if your legs are broken, what can you not do? You can't push up, so you can't breathe, and so you would suffocate. And so that's why, if you've ever wondered, if you're going to break their legs, like how is that going to help them die? Helps them die because they can't move. And if you can't move, then you can't breathe. There would have been an incredible sense of dehydration. That's why Jesus says, "I thirst." Whoever's in Psalm 22, read verse 15.
My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue clings to my jaws. You have brought me to the dust of death.
Okay. Referring to dehydration. Someone read verse 16.
For dogs have surrounded me. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They pierce my hands and my feet.
Okay, so that phrase, they pierce my hands and my feet. Some people have suggested that they possibly just tied Jesus' hands or Jesus' feet. But no, because Jesus said, "See here the prints in my hands." And also, another point about this is the hand during this point in time in the first century, I believe it's from the fingertip to the elbow. Is that correct? That was considered the hand. And so this was the arm, this was the hand. And so when it says that Jesus' hands were pierced, again, that was considered the hand, not the arm. So just a side note there. Let's see. John 19, verse 28, one of the statements that Jesus was able to speak, because again, you don't have a lot of excess oxygen to be speaking during crucifixion, and so that's not really a priority for you. So when Jesus speaks, again, I think that highlights the importance of what he's saying, because he's not going to waste his breath on something that doesn't have any significance. But in John 19, verse 28, Jesus says, "I thirst." Going back to the idea of dehydration. Yeah, thanks, Nate. Something else I learned is that the analgesic, the wine mixed with gall, it was a painkiller, a very weak painkiller. But that was a legal thing. That wasn't just, oh, we have some wine mixed with gall here. Here, you can have some if you'd like some. This was something that was Roman law. They would keep this on hand during crucifixions. So I thought that was interesting, that was actually custom to have that to be given to the to those being crucified. Did Jesus accept that wine mingled with gall? He declined it, didn't he? So they're offering you a painkiller, and you decline it. That's interesting. Any idea why he would have declined that?
I believe Isaiah 53 brings that out as relates to the pain that he endured for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the pain, it could have been that he didn't want to lose his faculties, his presence of mind. You know, of course, wine mixed with gall, you're going to lose yourself a little bit. He probably didn't want to lose his control over himself. Also, what about the passage that says that he's not going to drink of the fruit of the vine until he drinks it with us in the kingdom? I haven't looked into that too much, but I think there might be a connection there. I'll do some more research into that.
You have the Hebrews 5 text, he endured the cross, Hebrews 12 rather.
Okay.
So him enduring was very important. And then you think what we have to endure as children of God.
Yeah.
And sometimes there is nothing that's going to make that pain subside.
Yeah.
You have to endure it.
Okay. One other point that this doctor makes that I thought was interesting, fluid would eventually begin to fill his lungs and the space around his heart because of all the stress. Think of the stress that the heart is under at this point. You've got tachycardia, you've got low blood pressure, you've got high CO2 levels, you're not able to breathe, so there's low oxygen, so your heart is already having issues breathing. I believe the heart failure would more than likely begin, I believe, around hour 3. So heart failure just pretty much right off the bat. That was half of the time that Jesus was on the cross, and heart failure is already taking place. But fluid would begin to fill the space around his heart, the pericardium. Someone read Psalm 22, verse 14.
I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it has melted within me.
My heart is like wax. I wonder if that's a connection to his heart having issues beating. His heart is like wax, so it's difficult to beat, possibly because of that layer around the pericardium. I'm sorry?
Possibly congestive heart failure.
Congestive heart failure, some have said, is the reason for Jesus' death. So the crucifixion would have lasted, his crucifixion specifically, was from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. So 6 hours of this where you're unable to breathe, you're coming in and out of consciousness. Any comments, questions? Yes, ma'am.
I was looking at the sour wine passages. It almost seems like there's 2 different times where they offer Jesus sour wine.
Okay.
In Matthew 27.
Okay.
It looks like they gave him the sour wine and gall before he was crucified.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. The timeline of when they would have offered that. Good point.
It says in the John account that he received it. I don't know if that's the same as him drinking it.
Right.
Or just them offering it.
It could have been the same because it says that he tasted it the first time and he received it. So it could be that, but it could also be 2 separate events if the timeline was different. So yeah, good point. Hopefully this was helpful. Our goal tonight was not to be graphic. It was, however, to give us a better appreciation of what Jesus would have experienced on the cross. Sometimes in our minds, I think we can sterilize it, make it a little too simple, a little too clean. It was a nightmare. It was a nightmare, and it was perfected by years and years and years of making it as painful and as long-lasting as possible. So Jesus' final 24 hours is nothing short of a testament of his will, of his strength, of his character, and just of who he was as a person. It shows us in his darkest hours how good he was, that he was grace itself despite everything that he was going through. One of the final things that he said was that he was praying for those people who were responsible for the pain that he was in. I think that's as revealing as it gets about the kind of person that Jesus was. So if there's no closing comments or questions, then we'll conclude there.